Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Climate Justice, y'all, a podcast dedicated to lifting up and centering the climate and environmental justice movement in the South. Despite the South being the most biodiverse, diverse, and one of the largest economic engines in the world, we are underfunded and often barred from the decision-making table. Because of that, we decided to pull up a chair and amplify the stories of communities in the South that are being hit the hardest by the climate crisis. We're using good old-fashioned storytelling to shine a spotlight on these Southern leaders from all walks of life, putting in their blood, their sweat, and their tears to transform this region. The usage of y'all in the title's on purpose. We are honoring our Southern heritage of creativity, resilience, and ingenuity.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Marisha Malcolm, and I am joined here by Abigail Franks. In the South, where most of the states have right-to-work-based labor laws, and many of us live in impoverished areas, there is a desperate need for us to have a green, safe jobs and to grow our economy. We have a lot of work to do and are creating a great foundation to get us there.
Climate justice, y'all. It's real, it's here, and it's about time we listen to folks like Reverend Leo Woodbury from Kingdom Living Temple and Daniel Geronco from Tennessee Alliance for Progress, both of whom who have been fighting the good fight for years and have pushed for our economy to sustainably transform. Welcome, let's get started with the show.
So today, I guess we can start with Daniel first. Can you just introduce yourself and your organization, kind of go into a little detail about what your organization does and how'd you get into the fight?
Yeah, I'm in Nashville. I have several organizations, actually. One is Tennessee Alliance for Progress, which is a SEND member. It's a statewide organization focused on both racial justice and sustainability, and particularly a new green economy. And so I work in organizing and hosting conferences and trainings out of that group. I also coordinate both Tennessee Interfaith Power and Light, which again is a statewide organization focused on interfaith cooperation and advocacy around the climate crisis. And finally, I work with the Tennessee Conference of the United Methodist Church as a creation prayer coordinator. How I got into this, it's been a long time. I went to seminary back in Chicago. You know, out of my faith, I thought it was very important to live with and accompany the poor. And so I ended up with a community organization in Chicago, the Northwest Community Organization. And it happened to be, along with a group out in South Austin, which is on the west side of Chicago, at the forefront of energy justice. This was way back in the 1980s. In fact, the LIHEAP program came out of organizing from these groups. And we organized for the first statewide percentage of payment plan where low-income people could pay for gas and lights as a percentage of income. And we were also doing a lot of weatherization and also just struggling for lower rates for the moderate income people in our community. So we really forged a bond between the moderate income people and the low income people in our community to struggle for energy justice. It was a great interracial and interethnic organization, which is rare in Chicago. And so that's how I came into all this. About 20 years ago, I moved to Nashville. And I have been involved both with prison ministries out of the Vanderbilt Divinity School, and also once Inconvenient Truth came out, I decided that climate change was the compelling issue of our time. And so I got back to my roots in working on energy justice. And so it's been a long and winding story, I've been involved in community organizing and education around all this. And we have had a lot of focus on, again, the green economy in my work.
Okay. Well, thank you for your many, many long years of work.
Yeah, I've been working with Daniel for like a year now, and I didn't know any of that. So wow. I'm learning some. Thank you. Thank you. Rev Leo, what about you? Can you introduce yourself and your organization and what y'all do and how'd you get into this fight?
Okay, so I'm the pastor of Kingdom Living Temple and also executive director of New Alpha Community Development Corporation, both located in Florence, South Carolina. And so, like Daniel, I've been doing community organizing advocacy for a really long time. So going back to the 1960s, when first thing I did was when I was 14, I went on my first demonstration, went on some around the Vietnam War, but started off because then Mayor Robert Wagner had said that there would not be jobs available for youth that summer. That's when there were a lot of riots and they would try to employ inner city youth. I was living in Brooklyn in East New York in the projects. And then, and this is a term that really sounds funny today, then candidate John Lindsay, who describes himself as a liberal Republican. said that if he was elected, that there would in fact be a program for teens during the summer, that he would be able to match the federal dollars. And so I went across the street from my projects in East New York to his campaign office and got some campaign flyers, and then worked with the, you know, while in high school, we organized in Queens the first high school Black Students Union in New York City. Did some work with the Black Students Union, with the Black Panther Party, and pretty much have worked on a whole plethora of issues, like Daniel, some prison work, et cetera. So back in 1991 in Marion, South Carolina, we had a little group called the PD Community Center that was made up of three churches. St. Matthew Baptist Church, St. Stephen's Baptist Church, and Greater Singletary African Methodist Episcopal Church. And we formed something called the Marion Fellowship of Churches and opened up this community center for youth. Did a lot of mentoring, you know, traditional resisting peer pressure type of thing. And then we got to the health aspect, and someone from the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control gave me a book on fish advisory. And I wanted to know where was this mercury contamination coming from. And I found out that it was coal fire electric plants. And then that same year, I went to the first People of Colors conference in Mississippi, where people decided to move from the term environmental racism, often coined by Dr. Robert Bullard and his many books against the siting of polluting facilities in people of color community. And that began my journey. And so what we do now is we work in the areas of environmental justice, climate justice, and community economic development. We often say that we are at the nexus where environmental justice, where the environment and economics meet. So we have a term that we call environomics. And so we work in that sphere a lot, and in the climate justice sphere. So lifting up a few things that we're doing now, because we do work across the South. I'm the board chair of SIN. We do work nationally, primarily with U.S. Climate Action Network, Sierra Club, and some others. And then we work with Agricultural Missions Incorporated, another group I'm blessed to be the chair of. And we do work with 70 villages in Sierra Leone, Liberia. And recently, before the pandemic, started working with an NGO in Kilimanjaro, Tanzania. And so here in Florence, we have some hydro panels, otherwise known as air to water generators, and they're completely off grid. They're solar power. They pull air in, and then a thermal heating unit heats up the air. Water condenses, it's stored, and then pumped into the dispensing unit at our church. And we produce with only four panels 224 16-ounce bottles of water a week. And and we're working now on some electric vehicle issues. Excuse me. But what we're most excited about is that, what we're most excited about was 2 weeks ago, we signed the papers and we now hold the deed for 7.5 acres of land where we're planning to build an environmental justice and sustainability training center in a rural community, predominantly African-American, that has been in existence since 1739, but has had repeated flooding. And we're working with several organizations to mitigate the flooding and to develop some businesses there as we navigate our way from a fossil fuel-based economy to a clean, renewable energy-based economy. And we want to make sure that people who have a history of poverty and a history of pollution are included in this transition. I'll stop there.
Rev, you can always keep going. But I mean, that kind of directly leads to the next question. But first of all, I think it's awesome that both you and Daniel have almost like similar slash reflecting journeys of how y'all got to where y'all got to. I think that's so cool. And I didn't know that about y'all. And you thank y'all for kind of laying some of the foundation for the work that like Marisha and I do today. And we really, really appreciate it. But so this next question, since this is an episode about the need to transition our economy, and both of y'all work a lot with, you know, pushing for green jobs, you'll work a lot with ensuring that those who live in poverty have access to resources and everything. Can y'all talk about like what a sustainable economy would look like to y'all? And I can start off with Daniel.
Yeah, that's a very big question. I really feel that our...
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I think it's important to look at the big picture. That's a big question. I think as far, you know, the kind of the core economy in the world economy, you know, we've been based on conquests and hyper competition, longstanding racial injustices, indigenous communities displaced from their land. At the same time, we're very much out of balance, I think, in our society. We're finding that out in the pandemic. We both lack racial justice and we lack care for each other. And so people who are discriminated against or left out of this hyper-competitive economy are looked at as disposable. And so you have whole communities that are looked at as disposable communities that's traditionally been in what used to be called the inner city communities, but we're seeing that increasingly out in rural communities too. And at the same time, we look at things as the rest, the other creatures and the environment is disposable. And we try to dispose carbon into the atmosphere, and that's creating great problems for us. And so we've got a disposable society. And so we've got to turn that whole thing around that you're looking at all people having value and something that they contribute and that deserve dignified work, whether it's craft work, whether it's service work, whether it's, in what traditionally I thought of as the professions. And so good work that they can contribute to society, feel like they're contributing to society, but also treated with dignity and be able to bring in an income where they can sustain a family. And so that's important on the one end. On the other end, it's important that we look at regenerating and, again, kind of creating an economy where nothing goes to waste, nothing looks as it's disposable, but everything's integrated into to the economy. And so that the creation can do what it does, which is regenerate itself when you cycle things through. And so it's bringing these two things together, good work and also care for the greater creation in a way that it mirrors what God's creation does, which is, again, if you let it go right, it tends to, there is no waste out there. Instead, it tends to cycle things around. And so bringing those two things together, I think, is the real challenge in our time. At the same time, we've got to decarbonize it because, the most urgent problem is this huge climate crisis that we have, both in this country and, again, across the world. There is no way, if we put carbon up in the atmosphere, it affects the entire world. And so it's bringing good work together with this idea of creating a cycled economy, a recycled economy, where nothing goes to waste. And if we do that, again, we can care for our fellow creatures at the same time that all people can have dignity and can have good work in the economy. And so and there's a place in that economy for just about any kind of craft, trade, profession that you can think of. And so it's just reframing and refocusing the economy in those ways. But again, that's a huge endeavor that we're engaged in. It's both takes on concerns of justice and concerns of care for creation. So that's how I would answer it. And I'll turn it over to Reverend Leo.
Fantastic answer. Holy crap. I love disposable society. It's a good way to describe it. And Marisha said recycled economy where nothing goes to waste. But yeah, thank you, Daniel. Rev, what about you? What does a sustainable economy look like to you?
Yeah, Daniel hit the nail on the head so many times. But I'll come at it from a different perspective, you know. Basically, what we have to start off with is looking at balancing out our economy from the community level on up to the international level. When we look at the American Empire and the path that it has continued to take, like all great empires, is based on an imbalance. And in order to have an imbalance, that means that some have to have more than the others, and the people who are oppressed or colonized, exploited, etc. So when you do that, you create a scarcity that results in poverty and all of those sorts of things. So one of the things the pandemic has showed us is one of the false narratives because there are a lot of false narratives that fuel a consumer-based extractive economy. You have to have clothes that are the latest style, even though you don't need new clothes, You have to have those spinning rims on those tires, all of that sort of thing. And so when we look at what happened during the pandemic, we found out that there's an entire falsehood about communities being food deserts and food swamps. We saw people all over the country, distributing food that they bought, that they got from farmers, from parking lots and churches and community centers, which, at least taught us and some other people that the only reason there are food deserts and food swamps because we're waiting on some corporation to come in and to build a grocery store or a supermarket. And so, and what we also learned with that is that, we had lower emissions from fossil fuel-based vehicles. And when we look at developing local economies, like having food co-ops and selling our own food and growing our own flowers, making our own natural-based fertilizers, whatever kind of businesses that we create, we don't have to run into what we have and are continuing to run into today, which is a supply chain that is fragile and that is easily broken, from having a shortage of bleach to having a shortage of certain types of food to having a shortage of silicone chips for cars and computers, that we have to, instead of going bigger and bigger, we need to go smaller. We need to develop locally based economies. And that will provide jobs and entrepreneurial opportunities for many people. So, and then we have to look at what happens with expansion. Throughout the South in the 80s, early 90s, the South was prospering in a lot of places like South Carolina, but it was because the textile mills that originally were in New England, when the unions got strong and organized and they had to pay more money to the workers, they then moved to the South with right-to-work states that have very little union participation. They could work people for fewer benefits and for less dollars. And then with NAFTA, NAFTA moved our manufacturing base out of the country, you know, first to Texas and the Maquiladora corridor, and then into Central and South America. This is part of the reason why people are immigrating now, and now it's just, you know, India, Africa, all these places. And so expansion is not good, and we see that happening, whether we're looking at the utilities and, you know, what they have done, mountaintop removal, black lung disease. When we look at clean, renewable energy, it again puts an end to a false narrative that says all of us utilities, what economists call oligarchical monopolies, that it costs so much money for them to put the infrastructure in place that they may not get a return on their investment in a competitive society. So they get these monopolies established. That's why we don't have a choice of electric company. But with clean renewable energy, we know that solar companies can be smaller and they can exist in a more competitive environment, allowing people to attain what we often talk about when we say energy democracy. And so, you know, I'll wrap it up by saying that we have to get away from this notion of a good economy being an expanding economy globally, to the point of it being global, to having more local economies that, you know, can help us reduce the emissions that contribute to climate change and also can create jobs and can create, you know, community-based businesses and thereby help to move impoverished communities from surviving to thriving.
Rev, you did the transition segments. Oh my gosh, that leads us right into our next question. So like you stated, we need a local economy that's based on helping poverty and creating sustainability and creating thriving economies for these lower income communities. So with that, with transitioning to a clean and renewable economy, that means creating green jobs to help this transition. What is green jobs and why do we need them? Daniel, you can start us.
I really appreciate what Reverend Leo said about relocalizing the economy. I think that's an extremely important piece to this and to really integrate this in closely in our communities. People are finite people. We care for what's close to us. And so if we can build our economies to what's close to us, we can care with real, I think, concern. At the same time, keeping that global vision that we're all interconnected, we all share our global commons. And so keeping both there. But what is a green job? I would hope eventually we get to the point where all jobs are green jobs, again, that all jobs are integrated into that sustainable economy, but we're not there right now. And so we need jobs that are particularly focused on being green. And a lot, and Reverend Woodbury again lifted up a number of those kinds of opportunities. I'll give one example, one I've always liked from Baltimore. There's been a lot of disinvestment in Baltimore. Again, that abandonment, and so there's a lot of abandoned buildings in Baltimore. But there's a nonprofit there that trains youth in that community to deconstruct abandoned buildings. And so rather than destroying all the, there's a lot of really fine stuff in some of these abandoned buildings, rather than throwing that into a waste dump, deconstruct it in a way that you can resell a great deal of pieces from that abandoned structure, and they'll have a resale store. And that then those pieces of those abandoned buildings, you know, get built back into to new buildings. The income from that sales then supports this business as a social enterprise, and so you see all of those elements involved in that. And that's just one example of, you know, again, there's a lot in terms of solar panels, there's a lot in terms of weatherization, and so, but again, involving the young people, particularly the young adults in the community, or older people who are, you know, lack economic possibilities, into these enterprises in a way that brings all that together. And so that to me is an ideal green job. But again, we need to get to the point where all jobs within our economy could be considered green jobs. So that's my answer.
Yeah, that's, thank you, Daniel. That's, you know, that question is actually better posed as what jobs cannot become green jobs. And Daniel said, hopefully they all will be green jobs. Mm-hmm. But they range from little simple things, like in our travels in Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Southwest Georgia, Alabama, out in rural areas that have inland flooding from hurricanes, torrential rains, we hear people saying the same thing. They say, hey, the flooding is worse because the ditches haven't been cleaned out in 15, 20, 25 years. Those are actually shovel-ready jobs, you know, and cleaning out ditches may not be, you know, glorified or sexy like some of the more technical solutions, but those are actually green jobs. Where there's a lot of flooding, getting into green infrastructure, you know, making sure that more trees are planted and that they're indigenous trees, so that they're not loblolly pine plantations that disrupt the biodiversity of an area and eventually impacts the entire ecosystem. You know, you have crops that can be grown using green technology and not using some natural indigenous methods instead of pesticides and herbicides. You know, so many different things in the rural area. And then in the urban area, you know, doing small scale solar projects, doing energy efficiency, making sure that areas, and they're usually in people of color and low income communities, where there's not a lot of greenery, planting trees to help with the spiking heat in those communities, replacing rooftops with reflective surfaces. You know, moving on to even big projects like having more electric powered trains. There's a lot of diesel trains. If you've ever ridden Amtrak going north or south, when you get into Washington, D.C., there's a half hour delay while they take off the diesel powered engine and put on the electric engine. And, you know, that's a huge thing because in the congressional infrastructure plan, there's a lot of money that's going to the railways industry like Amtrak, and, you know, which also brings up the question, why isn't there more railway that runs west, particularly in the southeast? Why is not Charleston, which is a growing city with the expansion of the port, and it, you know, why is it not connected to Atlanta, which is a growing area? Why are we not connected to Texas, one of the fastest growing states in this country? So when we look at rail in the South, there's a tremendous opportunity to expand electric trains, but also to expand a transportation system that will connect some of the fastest growing and wealthiest areas in the South with one another. And so we, you know, from from cleaning out ditches in rural areas all the way up to, rebuilding our transportation system so that it's more equitable and can open up how many more smaller southern cities and communities to, being able to ship in goods directly using clean energy and connecting towns and relatives, So it's really, I could go on and on, but there's so many opportunities if we can just break our dependency, not only on fossil fuels, but this whole energy, this energy model that actually discourages and actually suppresses the development of green jobs and clean renewable energy.
I could literally listen to y'all talk for hours. Oh my gosh. But I mean, that's so true. And we're outgrowing these old economic models, and they're not working for us anymore. We're growing very quickly. And like I mentioned in the intro, the South has one of the largest economies in the world. And we got to make sure that we are taken care of and that every job becomes green, like both of y'all said. But that being said, this whole thing is daunting. This whole thing is immense. There's a lot of issues and a lot of intersecting issues that we need to deal with in order to transform our economy. And so I want to close this podcast by asking y'all, what gives y'all hope? What keeps y'all going, especially since y'all have been in this fight for years? We'll start off with Daniel.
Yeah, several things. Again, sometimes I do despair, but I'm also a person of faith. So I think ultimately my hope comes through my faith. And it's not an underworldly faith, but it's a faith that is very much engaged with the creation that we're a part of. What gives me hope is several things. I mean, it's the work that people like Reverend Woodbury are doing. That very much gives me hope. There's very tangible and a lot of knowledge there. The other thing that gives me hope is that so many young people are embracing this and also pushing this. And so that gives me a lot of hope. It doesn't depend on people like myself, but there's a whole cloud of witnesses out there, as it were, particularly amongst young people that are really embracing a sustainable economy as opposed to a disposable economy. And so that gives me hope.
Yes, Daniel, I like you. Faith is a large component. And, I'll just quote, and I say this oftentimes to people who, and a lot of young people who may not be into organized religion or have their membership in a congregation. The scripture that says, faith is the substance of things hope for, the evidence of things not seen. And so if we're not focused on now, but realize, as Dr. King said, that the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And, after you look at things over a span of time, and when we were younger, Daniel, it seemed like things seemed harder and farther away, but you just figure that now. I grew up in New York. I was never in a segregated school, but my wife in the South, who's a year younger than me, did not go to an integrated school until she was in her senior year in high school. But now that's ridiculous. The fact that today that people of different races can be friends. And as Dr. King said again, that a little white girl and a little black boy can sit together and be friends. You could get lynched for that. And we're only talking about one generation away, when we look at the fact that, the concept of environmental justice started in a little town in Warren County, North Carolina, where people were laying down in front of trucks because they didn't want PCB contaminated materials in their community. And we look at today in environmental justice, that concept bred in that little tiny rural place, but that concept now is not only known all over the country, it's being embraced by the White House. They talk about it in United Nations gatherings. And so we all winning. We all winning. We all making change. But it's long, hard work, and we have to stay ever vigilant because, as we know from the last presidential election, if we relax our guard, yes, the tide can change and not in our favor. And so, you know, keep your eye on the long game. You know, keep your eyes on the prize. And that is what will give you hope and embrace every little victory, every little change. You know, you can't win with it being doom and gloom, and that shouldn't be the message. That's one of the things that really hurts our movement. You know, every successful movement, every battle for freedom always has positive messages from Adam Clayton Powell, Reverend and Congressman Adam Clayton Powell saying, keep the faith, baby, and to Jesse Jackson saying, I am somebody, to, you know, Barack Obama saying, yes, we can, in the words, we shall overcome. We have to have a positive message. A message that empowers people, encourages people to really believe and to really strive to make that change. But, you know, as we often say, that change begins in us. So we get disillusioned, but it's faith and it's hope and it's keeping our eye on the future. That is what keeps us going, and that is how we win.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.